Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 24th of November. And it is Monday at 9, which means it's time for our All Things Political Hour. We have a lot to talk about this hour because our guest is from Minnesota. We'll be looking at the Al Franken Norm Coleman race and find out when that will be decided. And I guess it's only, 115 or so votes that's separating the two of them. We'll talk about the votes that will make a difference here in the final days of counting the votes. Of course, we'll examine the transition team. A lot of word has come out about the economic team, which President-elect Obama is supposed to unveil sometime today, so we will look at that. And news over the weekend that he gave us that he plans an economic recovery plan, putting 2.5 million people to work. It's a huge economic recovery plan, costing something like $700 billion, which he hopes will jumpstart the economy. And he did make some news this weekend as well, saying that perhaps, he didn't say this, but there are reports that perhaps the tax cuts for the wealthy, the repeal of that, will be held off until the year 2011 when they naturally expire. So we have much to talk about here, and we'll welcome phone calls as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. We're happy to welcome back Professor Lawrence Jacobs, Director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs and a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Minnesota. Professor Lawrence Jacobs, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you again. Yeah.
Why don't we start with that Franken-Coleman race? It's just amazing how few votes separate the two of them. Does it depend now on absentee ballots? What's going on with that?
Well, it is going to depend on the absentee ballots in part. And there are several big events coming up. The State Canvassing Board, which is a very balanced, tripartisan board, has got a big decision to make on Wednesday as to whether to count these ballots. The big issue there is, are these validly cast ballots, therefore it should be part of the recount, or is this part of the contested part of the election that the courts need to settle in another process?
And what are they validly cast? Why would there be thoughts that they were not validly cast?
Well, there are several different rules as to whether absentee ballots are actually valid and therefore should be counted, including whether the voter is registered and has included the appropriate registered information, whether they've signed the absentee ballot in the appropriate places. And, you know, usually there are some number of absentee ballots that fail to meet that and are thrown out. But the Franken campaign has identified some number of ballots, perhaps numbering dozens or even hundreds, that they say should be counted, were not counted. They are valid ballots and should be part of this recount process.
Mm.
Now, the key issue here is that the recount is literally supposed to count the ballots that were cast and should have been cast for the candidates. The Coleman people come back and say, wait, that's a very narrow administrative process. Simply go back and take the ballot that was already counted for Coleman or Franken and re-add it. The Franken campaign is coming and saying, no, wait a second. It says in statute that it's validly cast ballots. These are valid ballots. They should now be counted, even though they weren't counted before.
I see. And how many votes separate the two right now?
Well, of course, we don't really know. I mean,
right.
If you go to the Secretary of State's office, they'll show you several thousand. Separate them, but we've got several different media organizations kind of doing counts by the precincts as they come in. Some show the lead about 180 for Senator Coleman. Others show it down about 115. But the big factor here is there are about 4,000 ballots that have been challenged.
Mm-hmm.
And what we don't know, at least publicly, is what are the nature of those challenges. There is an assumption that perhaps the majority of them are just going to be set aside by both campaigns. Will agree, well, our people on the ground made a mistake here, or that, you know, that'll never be counted. But there may also be some number, and we don't know the balance, where, let's say, the Coleman people see that Franken might pick up a vote, and they're going to try to make a case that it shouldn't be, but at the end of the day, it'll come down as a Franken vote. And we don't know the resolution of that. So a big, big question here, just what happens with these challenge ballots? And that's something that's going to be decided in December.
It certainly is one of those cases, glaringly so, that you look at this and say, ah, one vote does matter, doesn't it?
It sure does. It's going to come down. It could be that close, though I continue to think there's a chance that it won't come down to, you know, a handful or a couple dozen votes. There, you know, we've got, you know, some number of absentee ballots that I think eventually will be counted. We've got this, you know, 4,000 set of challenge ballots, and we still have about a third of the electorate, you know, a third of the votes to be recounted. Many of those seem to be in some of the larger urban areas.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move to national politics for a moment. Not that that's not national politics, it indeed is. President-elect Obama, sometime today, going to be announcing his economic team and over the weekend talking about a huge economic recovery plan, $700 billion, putting 2.5 million people to work. He was called on by some to do that. This is a big thing. This is a big move.
This is extraordinary. You know, usually the transition team goes off to a small town and they kind of just huddle. And they have the kind of, you know, this kind of pre-honeymoon period where they kind of measure the drapes and that sort of thing, and they have nice conversations. What's extraordinary now is that you've got basically a lame duck Congress. You've got a president who's, you know, heading out the door, doesn't have much power to begin with, and the economy's falling apart. Our financial system is in crisis. So there's a lot of pressure on the president-elect to come forward with policy proposals, but of course, he's not president. And the Congress is an old former Congress. The new Congress is going to be much more heavily Democratic. So we're in a very, very awkward period. What the Obama campaign is trying to do is to signal to the financial markets that it understands the severity of the crisis. It does have, will have a team in place and has a general plan for saving or creating this two and a half million jobs, in the hopes that that will kind of give them 2 months before they're actually sworn in.
Because the news is so awful every day, Professor Jacobs, including the Citigroup news yesterday and dealing with it today, you certainly, 2 months seems like almost too long right now, doesn't it? You don't know what economic news is ahead next week, this week, a couple weeks from now.
Well, it is very bad, and it's extremely awkward. I mean, just by comparison, if you go back to when FDR was sworn in, he was actually not inaugurated until March, even though he was elected in November. So it was even longer back then. I think the key thing here is twofold. One is this signaling to markets that, because a lot of what's going on is uncertainty and fear and panic. And what the Obama campaign, or now president-elect, is trying to do is to signal and to create some assurance and to reduce that sense of uncertainty. They have no power. It is the president's call, and he's made it pretty clear that there's some things he's just not going to support. So there's not much in practice that the Obama new administration can do at this point. The second thing, though, is putting in place the economic team, because the economic team can, you know, under the radar, now start working with the Bush economic team. And in some areas, they are going to be able to work together, even though they couldn't, you know, pass legislation in this Congress or get this president to sign legislation that the Obama team would want.
So in what areas can they work together?
Well, I think we probably saw a little bit of it with the Citibank effort. I suspect in some of the ways in which mortgages are going to be handled. There seems to be a bit more openness to trying to step into the mortgage market in a way that the Obama team has signaled that it's supportive. President Bush did sign the extension on employment benefits. Those are all, you know, small signals of what's to come. And, of course, the scope of the stimulus package that's being talked about in combination with the apparent decision not to eliminate the Bush tax cuts,
right,
all are really aimed at signaling the market to create more confidence and to kind of draw the oxygen out of this panic.
How can you hold off on repealing the tax cuts when Obama talked about that so much during his campaign and talked about it as a way to fund some of the programs that he needs to fund?
Well, obviously, it's going to be a finesse here. Now, what's happening is the tax cuts will not be extended. And so he is fulfilling that campaign promise. The issue is whether they're actually going to pass legislation to do that sooner than the natural fade-out in 2011. There are several arguments here. One is the economic one, which is, you know, raising taxes during a recession, not a good idea because you're drawing money out of the marketplace at a time when you want as much money in there as possible. The other may well be a political calculation that this is a kind of an olive branch to some Republicans who do support those tax cuts. It shows, you know, some respect for those Republicans. Certainly not going to win over, I would say, a majority to the Obama campaign, but it may help with some.
Mm-hmm. Before we go to phone calls, just your overall reaction to the cabinet choices that have been floated about. Did some names strike you as, whoa, this is a great decision, and did some names make you think this could be troublesome?
Well, overall, I think it's been a good team. I think the Hillary Clinton choice was politically and policy-wise a very shrewd one. In terms of policy, despite the campaign rhetoric, they largely agree. The reality is this is an economic administration. Barack Obama needs to be able to basically hand off the foreign policy issues to someone who's got the kind of standing and someone that he knows relatively well, even though they're not personally close, and who share, you know, kind of a broad policy orientation. And I think that's kind of what's going on here. But politically, it's very important because it removes a potential rival in Congress, someone who may have had some interest in challenging him at some point down the road, and, you know, all the team of rival kind of comparisons we've been hearing about with reference to Abraham Lincoln's cabinet.
He sure is reading a lot of Lincoln, isn't he? You got to like that.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of, it's interesting, the press, the way in which the Obama transition has been handling the press. The campaign, of course, was very buttoned down, but we're getting a lot of information about decisions before they're made, and even the president-elect's reading. The focus on Lincoln really kind of playing up this crisis. And I think one of the most interesting comments during this period since election was by Rahm Emanuel just after Election Day, when he said something to the effect, "You never want to let a crisis go to waste. It's an opportunity."
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very important point, and often presidents struggle to create the perception of crisis because it opens up the agenda and opportunity for pushing policy proposals. We're going to see, I think, the Obama administration push a whole lot of its policies, you know, within this general set of initiatives to strengthen the economy. Its agenda on the environment, and particularly shifting our energy focus. Many of its efforts on jobs and even health care are going to kind of get wrapped into the financial and economic crisis.
Lawrence Jacobs is our guest for All Things Political this Monday morning, director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs, and professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Minnesota. Our lines are filled, but keep the number in mind because eventually you'll be able to get through. The number is 800-486-8655. Email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now and start with Michael from Hastings, Minnesota. Hi, Michael.
Good morning.
Hello.
Hello. Good morning, Professor. Could you help me with something that I'm really having some problems understanding, and the potential for any revisiting of absentee mail-in ballots? Is there a precedent in Minnesota history for that? And I'd like to hold on here, if you wouldn't mind. I may have a follow-up.
All right.
Could you just give me a little bit more, Michael, in terms of what it is
I beg your pardon. I'm just curious if there's any precedent in Minnesota election history for revisiting spoiled absentee ballots.
Well, okay, so there are a couple issues here. The last time we had this kind of close contested election back in 1962-63 in terms of statewide races, the issue about spoiled absentee ballots actually cuts to the core of what the dispute is. The Coleman campaign argues that these are not, these ballots have already been decided. Now, the Franken campaign comes back and now has some evidence from the different counties that have released information on the absentee ballots that there are some number of absentee ballots for which there is no reason given for why they weren't opened. And we actually have started to be able to identify some number again. What that number is open to question of ballots that were validly cast but were not open. Now, there could be several reasons for it. Election turnout in Minnesota was very high. It was about 78%. The absentee ballot is not one thing. There's actually six different absentee ballots. And there are a number of criteria for when to open them and under what condition they're valid. Given the frantic business on election day and election night, we know that some of those ballots raised questions, and the election workers never got back to them and just put them aside. So those are valid ballots. They're not all of them are spoiled. Some of them, most of them probably are and should not be open. But some number of them will be open at the end of the day, whether it's part of the recount or as part of the contested election phase.
Your follow-up, Michael?
I'm still a little confused. If you wouldn't mind, I know your time is limited. I want other people to be able to ask questions as well. But how many different categories, literally, are there of mail-in absentee ballots?
As I said, there's six. There are, you know, for federal elections, for state elections. We have also ballots for our military personnel. And this year in Minnesota, military personnel could also vote online, which is an innovation which unfortunately hasn't gotten much attention.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's a very innovative program.
Huh.
If we weren't wrapped up in this, we could have a nice discussion about what that might mean for the electorate overall. But in any case, there are these different categories. And again, from a simple administrative point of view, most elections, we would not be talking about such a small number of ballots. Our election system is very good in Minnesota. It is considered one of the best in the country. But we're now down to kind of differences of, you know, 1/1000th of a percent. These are tiny, tiny differences. Even a bank has a hard time keeping track of pennies at that level. And that's kind of the point we're in. There are, as I said, two different ways in which the absentee ballots that were not counted will be handled. One is, on Wednesday, the state canvassing board, and I think this needs to be emphasized, the state canvassing board consists of two Minnesota Supreme Court justices who were appointed by a Republican governor. It includes a Ramsey County judge who was appointed by Jesse Ventura and has actually also served a very prominent role in terms of the ethical responsibility of judges. There's another Ramsey County judge who is elected. And then you've got the Secretary of State, who's a Democrat. Now, that is a pretty balanced board. And I think for a lot of folks, the decision of this board will not only have the rule of law, but it'll have some real credibility. Now, Wednesday, they're going to make a decision about whether it is appropriate for the recount process to open up these absentee ballots and consider those that were not counted. Now, they may decide not to and say this is not part of the recount process, in which case that could become, and my hunch would be it will become, part of the legal process.
Sure.
Of going to a court and a judge and saying, you know, this wasn't, this ballot wasn't open or these ballots weren't open, and it should be open, or it could become part of a case filed by one of the voters who who did cast an absentee ballot and want their ballot opened and feel that they were, you know, wronged and denied their rights as a citizen.
So this could this case possibly go all the way to the Supreme Court?
Conceivably, but, you know, there's a lot of state law here and a tendency for the Supreme Court to defer to the state courts on this.
I see. Thanks very much, Michael, for your call. Let's go to Paul from Duluth next. Hi, Paul.
Hello, Kathleen, and thank you to your guest. As someone who voted absentee, you've just kind of unmuddied the waters for me a little bit, but that's not what I called about. I was watching Late Edition on CNN yesterday, and Thomas Friedman, the economist, proposed that George Bush stepped down before January 20th so that Barack Obama could take over. And I guess I just want your opinion if of what the likelihood of that might be and if there's any precedent for it. And I'll take your answer off the air.
Thank you, Paul.
I think, as a student of the presidency, I think it's highly improbable that President Bush is going to step down. I think what we're more likely to see is efforts by the administration, and particularly the cabinet, sub-cabinet, officials in the Bush administration working with the Obama team, particularly now that there is a emerging Obama economic team. The reason why President Bush is not going to step down is partly political, of course. He doesn't want to kind of so directly acknowledge that his presidency is over and have the kind of historical stain of doing that. But it's also, you know, constitutional. We have a process. It's a process that I think we're all proud of, rightfully so. And when you start kind of redoing the process on the fly because of, you know, these kind of emergencies, it's the kind of thing that makes people nervous, mm-hmm. and particularly in a country that's guided by the rule of law and a constitutional system.
Thanks very much for your call. Let's talk a little bit more about the people Obama is bringing in. John Harwood had an interesting article in yesterday's New York Times that he's bringing pieces of Chicago to the White House, people like Valerie Jarrett and David Axelrod. But even after vowing to turn the page on the polarized politics of the baby boom generation, he has made it clear that service in the Beltway wars of the last 20 years is not only acceptable, but in some cases necessary for his purposes. What do you think of that?
Well, clearly the top positions are going to people who have had Washington experience. On the other hand, particularly at this juncture, how could it be otherwise? I mean, if he started appointing folks who were new to the way Washington worked, you would be in for a predictably long a period of transition. And I think for a lot of folks who study the presidency, the Carter administration comes to mind immediately because he brought in this whole group of folks from Georgia. They were known as the Georgia Cabinet that did not have Washington experience. President Carter, of course, was governor of Georgia, did not have Washington experience himself. Walter Mondale, who was the vice president, had that. But, of course, he was the vice president and wasn't running the show. There's just not enough time for that sort of thing this time around.
Mm-hmm.
I would say I think President-elect Obama is trying to balance the kind of the experience that's needed with the infusion of some new blood. I think it's kind of interesting under each of the major cabinet post positions or White House positions. There's usually one or two people just underneath that you start seeing emerge who are people who have been close to Barack Obama during the campaign. The names that are not really kind of floating to the top in terms of the press headlines, but these are Obama's people. So I think it's going to be a combination of both. And when we study the presidency, we often talk about these two cycles. One is in terms of the honeymoon period in which the president has the most capital politically. They're coming in, there's a kind of a groundswell, there's a hopefulness. There's kind of give the president, new president, the benefit of the doubt. And so that's good. But in terms of experience, the president is at the lowest step. because they're newbies. And as a rookie, they're going to make mistakes. And it looks as if Barack Obama is trying to basically come in and start at a higher level in terms of experience by bringing in people who've done this before, who know how the process works, and then bringing in the Obama people just underneath them to make sure that the new president's agenda is actually followed.
Mm-hmm. It is when you think about it, isn't it? I'm still dumbfounded by what he's done, Professor Jacobs. It's not only that, but this huge embrace for him among many people in this country. I was interested in looking at the New York Times bestseller list nonfiction yesterday, and four of the books are about Obama, two of his books and two books about him.
Well, this is an extraordinary moment in America. I mean, obviously, the racial barrier and the first African-American president, that's an incredible moment, and a moment, frankly, that I don't think could happen anywhere in Europe today. I mean, in France, Germany, there are race riots or, you know, riots involving new immigrants of color.
Yes.
So that's an extraordinary moment. I think that helps to account for it. But it's also clearly an important political moment in America. We've had, you know, if you kind of just look at the pendulum, we had the New Deal, which kind of expanded government. And then there was a kind of a settling down during the Eisenhower years. Then the Great Society kind of surged forward with more government. And then there was a backlash under Richard Nixon. And really, it carried on through the Carter, Reagan, and Clinton presidencies. And then the recent Bush presidency. And now we've got this financial crisis, and it looks as if the pendulum is swinging back again towards a larger role for government and a kind of a repudiation of some of the policies supported by the Republican Party in terms of smaller government and lower taxes. So this, you know, I think that's part of it, too. It's a kind of a combination of a shift in our political environment with this extraordinary moment in America's, journey and conflict over race.
We go next to Gary from Madison. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I just wanted to stay up.
Oh, the phone's real bad, Gary. Can you make it better? No, it got worse. Call us back, Gary, because you make an interesting point. Ed from West Allis. Hi.
Well, it's been nearly 3 weeks since Barack Obama showed up at a UAW Union Hall on Election Day in Indianapolis to make phone calls. And boy, have we been trashed in the labor movement. We've had absolutely no discussion of who his candidates are for labor secretary. We had no representation on November 7th in Chicago when he announced his economic team. And Mr. Axelrod on the ABC News program yesterday basically told the UAW members that they're not going to get a bailout, though Citibank would. And the other part of the puzzle here for us is Hillary, because Hillary, obviously, in the Senate, is going to be the only spokesman, the only effective spokesman that organized labor is going to have. I would love to see Ted Kennedy take on that role. I don't think he can do that. And this is a reason for her to say to Mr. Obama, thanks, but no thanks, for the Secretary of State position. Because as we're inching up to a 13.1% unemployment rate that we hit in February of 1983, and we're close to 8% now, you're going to start to see the people in the streets, especially when these facilities for General Motors close in December in Ohio and in Janesville, Wisconsin.
Professor Jacobs.
Well, you know, Ed, you raised huge points, and of course, one of the tensions in the Democratic Party is that its relationship with the labor movement has been uneven, to put it mildly. Some people refer to it as a barren marriage because labor is not benefited as it wanted, as it has expected. And I think you're right in pointing to the fact that the labor movement has not been represented Labor Department secretary will be an important appointment, and that, you know, will be coming. And I think there's probably an expectation will be someone that has close ties to the labor movement. But there's no doubt that the kind of, you know, large manufacturing unions are being kind of given a back seat so far in the Obama administration and in Washington. We had the unseating of John Dingell last week by Henry Waxman, and that was, you know, seen and intended to be a kind of a ratcheting down of the auto industry role, and with Dingell being blamed for the resistance to upgrading fuel efficiency and other sorts of changes in the auto industry. And it was very clear from Mr. Axelrod yesterday that the Obama administration agrees with the Democratic leadership in Congress that they will not approve financial help for the auto industry unless the auto industry restructures itself. So I don't take that as a no. I take that as a kind of a more subtle and nuanced position, which is we're willing to give you support, but it's not for the same old thing. And this is part of my point about crisis being the opening for the Obama administration to push a whole set of policies, including its effort to change the energy footprint of America, which is going to have to involve the auto industry. So I think that's a story still to be told, but I do agree with you that I think the labor movement, particularly the labor movement in the large manufacturing industry, has been given a backseat so far.
Thanks for the call, Ed. Our phone number, we have lines open if you've been trying to get through. It's All Things Political. Our guest is Professor Lawrence Jacobs, Director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs and a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Minnesota. Did I give you the number? It's 800. I think I did. I can't remember. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And let's go to an email now. Professor Jacobs, Donald from Fish Creek writes on the bailout question, if anybody can comment, that means you, on the numbers of dollars already spent, loaned, or whatever. Bloomberg has it at $2 trillion, and that same $2 trillion is all but entirely unaccounted for as to where actually it is and what it's being used for. Your comments.
Well, it is. It's over $2 trillion. And, you know, this involves a variety of different kinds of commitments. Some of it are outright sums of money that have been kind of handed over to some of these financial institutions to prop them up. In some cases, it's been in exchange for various kinds of equity positions, preferred stock. In other cases, the money that this over $2 trillion that's been committed has been committed in terms of loans. And, you know, the hope is, and we've seen this before, that those loans are paid back. And, you know, at least optimistically, these investments that the government has made in financial institutions will turn out and actually, you know, could produce a return for the government. So the final kind of tab on this is not known, but the commitment thus far in terms of subsidies and loan guarantees is over $2 trillion. We're dealing with a huge sum of money, and that sum is going up and will go up considerably. We've now got this, you know, $700 billion stimulus package that is being talked about over 2 years. So that's, you know, it's going up.
Right. It is so much money. We say these figures, and you say, oh, this is a lot of money.
It is a huge amount of money.
Yeah.
And the thinking here, and this is a very important point, is that when you are in a financial crisis, the crisis turns into a systemic disaster if the banks and the other financial institutions do not have the money to loan and to pay. And so the main focus here, and this is why the Obama administration is putting so much attention on the economic team and the bailouts or the rescue packages, is because you've got to have liquidity in the financial system. You've got to have the money in the vaults so you don't get a run on your banks or your other financial institutions. That's the focal point at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the expectation is that, you know, at the end of the day, some years down the road, that we'll look back, it'll certainly be a lot of money having been spent, but it'll be considerably less than the $2+ trillion that's going out the door at this point.
Right. More phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, the second hour of our program today, we'll be talking about Proposition 8, which passed in California. Our guest, the legal director at Lambda Legal, which is the oldest and largest national legal organization committed to achieving full recognition of the civil rights of lesbians, gay men, bisexuals, transgender people, and people with HIV. All right, back to phone calls now. We go to Diane from Milwaukee. Hi, Diane.
Thank you, Kathleen, for taking my call.
Sure.
Hundreds of thousands of people voted early on absentee ballots. Are you telling me that I shouldn't bother to do that because they're not opened or counted?
Absolutely not. We're talking about a very small proportion of absentee ballots that are in question in Minnesota. You know, at this point, we're very early into the process. The recount process just started this past week. Minnesota, there will be either an administrative resolution of those absentee ballots, or there will be a series of court rulings on them. Actually, the court rulings have already started. It's very important to know that there is a clear process for this. In Minnesota, there is a very strong orientation toward acknowledging and recognizing counting voter intent. So if there's a kind of a doubt within the established rules, it goes toward the voters to make sure the voter intent. Now, this is important because we had about a third of the ballots cast this year in early voting. And given the very high turnout in our recent elections, it's quite possible that that number will grow over time. And I think it would be a mistake to kind of conclude from a very small number of cases in Minnesota that the early voting process and the absentee ballot process is, you know, flawed, and that large numbers of ballots are being thrown out. That is not the case. This is a good process.
You reassured, Diane?
Thank you very much.
Okay.
So you're saying I can still vote absentee, and I have a pretty good chance that my ballot will be counted?
Yes, actually, in Minnesota.
What is the case where my ballot won't be counted? What criteria?
Well, two of the most common are that people don't sign the outside of the envelope, or they don't provide information regarding registration.
Hmm.
Now, in Minnesota, if you do send your ballot in up to a week before Election Day, if there's a mistake, the election officials will get in touch with you and let you know. This primarily comes up with people who are literally voting at the last minute. So like so much else in life, don't leave it to the last minute. Vote earlier. Get your ballot in. If there's a problem, and if you live in Minnesota, the good election officials here will get in touch with you and try to help you walk you through how that's done.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
Let's go next to Marilyn from Cleveland. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to point out to your guest, when he's defending Obama's reneging on his promise to raise taxes on the super, super rich, and it's true that in a downward cycle like we are now, we don't want to raise taxes, but he seems to have overlooked the fact that Obama said he was going to decrease taxes on the middle class. And in fact, he was called a socialist for redistributing money. He's not just subtracting it. He is redistributing it. And it is the middle class who is much more apt to go out and buy things to stimulate the economy, whereas the super rich, maybe they'll buy an eighth and a ninth house or a yacht, but it's we middle class who are going to give a kickstart to the economy.
Well, Professor?
Just to be clear, we don't have a President Obama yet. So
that's true.
We're just dealing with, you know, frankly, leaks and in some cases maybe an accurate rumor. And this is a very awkward, kind of historically unique situation where an administration that's not yet in office is being kind of at least held accountable in the court of public
opinion. That's true. That's true.
For policies that they have not put forward. They don't even have a cabinet yet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just to be clear in terms of the rumors and some of the ideas that were floated by some of the president-elect's aides, he's not talking about reneging on his commitment to raise the taxes on the highest income Americans. It's simply a matter of when that happens. It will happen, and he's not in any way backed away from that. The law that was passed by President Bush in Congress back in the early part of his presidency had a 10-year window in terms of that tax cut, and there was a kind of an accounting reason for doing that. And then the president argued we should extend it and make it permanent. That was never done. And the question now is, when is that tax cut kind of eliminated? Do you just let it eliminate by way of the usual a calendar as it was set up by Congress and President Bush back in 2000, early 21st century? Or do you do it sooner? And Barack Obama allegedly is saying, well, let's just let it terminate by its own schedule. Now, in terms of the tax cuts for the middle class, this is an area we don't really know much yet. But again, if you kind of read closely some of the leaks, it appears that is fully part of what the Obama team may be rolling out, as well as infrastructure spending of a massive amount and other sorts of financial commitments to get the economy going. I think we just need to give this team a little bit more time. It's not that they haven't unpacked yet. They haven't even moved yet.
It's true. I wonder, too, I follow this all pretty carefully, but I wonder where that came from. If it was a leak that somebody from the administration said this is a possibility, because it's being reported as fact, or at least it was over the weekend, and so much is coming from sources within the campaign who are talking to the press. Did he say this, or did I miss something?
Several of his advisors or people who've been talking with him had come out and said it. So you had, people like Larry Summers or Mr. Axelrod, who's a campaign manager, kind of coming out and just, mentioning these as possibilities.
I see.
So, again, it's a very odd sort of process. And what they've always said is, well, these are ideas being kicked around. There is no, administration yet. There is no policy. And again, we probably wouldn't even be seeing this if we weren't in such a pickle right now with our financial and economic systems. There is a need to kind of talk and try to reduce the sense of uncertainty that's currently, I think, driving a panic on Wall Street and with our businesses. We don't want business leaders to be cutting jobs in anticipation of a depression-era sort of downturn in the economy. Just hold off, give us a couple more months. That's basically what the Obama team wants everyone to do.
Thanks very much, Marilyn, for your call. Let's go to Ken from Milton next. Hi, Ken.
Hello. I'm going to talk about the automotive situation in that we're dealing with a situation that's pretty old, and I wish I could remember when we were talking about CAFE standards for cars, where the automotive people did not, and I want to repeat, for cars, when we had the long gas lines after that, I think it was the early 90s, the automotive companies did not want it, Congress compromised, and they put standards on efficiency standards on cars, but they didn't on trucks. And the automotive people were lucky enough, where the cost of oil went down to $20 a barrel, and these big trucks that we saw on the road did not have any standards. Is why we have them on the road, or have had them on the road. And it's why we've had these ugly cars for the 25 years, and that basically Detroit just forgot about cars. and built these great big trucks, and they should have been forward-looking enough to realize that this is a temporary situation, and they were not.
All right, Professor Jacobs.
Well, it's a combination of things, and I agree with Ken that there was a short-sightedness on the part of the auto industry, though, frankly, if you look at the finance sector, I don't know what's shorter than short-sightedness, but
right.
Kind of look through the decisions that Citibank and a number of the others that have gone under or close to going under, and there was a kind of a quarterly orientation for driving up profits, even if they weren't sustainable, that has gotten us in huge trouble. So there was short-sightedness in the auto industry. We've seen it elsewhere. And they did block the extension and expansion of fuel efficiency standards to trucks. They also blocked efforts to increase fuel efficiency standards for cars. And, you know, they're paying a price for that in terms of market share vis-a-vis the Japanese car makers and the South Korean car makers. But there's another element to this, which is the overall financial and economic crisis. And that has, you know, kind of dried up the customer base that any business has got to count on. You make projections
mm-hmm.
using a certain baseline, and essentially that baseline doesn't exist anymore. I recently went out to a car lot, and it was like a ghost town.
Mm-hmm.
I was almost the only person on this huge car lot. And that's a disaster, and it reflects a much broader kind of economic meltdown. And that's partly what this is about and how you respond to it. And I think what we're seeing, the Democratic leadership and the some of the Obama team starting to say is, look, we're willing to help you, but you're going to need to start thinking much more prospectively about the kind of industry this is going to need to be in order for us to reposition ourselves in terms of energy demand, but also for you to become a much more viable business.
Right.
Because if we just pour in money, then you're going to end up back here again pretty soon.
You wonder, don't you? We can't go ahead 5 years, but I sure wonder what the whole industry is going to look like 5 years from now, Lawrence.
Well, it's quite possible, this could be the cutting edge of an American economic rebound. With cars, you know, there's some prototypes out there that are getting 50 or 100 miles a gallon, depending on fuel cells that are being used. That could, you know, catapult America into the forefront. But it's going to require a huge change. Some of the Democratic leaders in Congress are saying it requires such a change that if they're going to put in money, they want to see an entirely new leadership team in the automakers, and that the top executives will need to step down. Now, whether that happens, open question, but it gives you a sense of the kind of transformation
right.
that's probably going to be required.
Well, it is unbelievable that these guys would fly in their fancy jets separately, no less, and come to Washington asking for a huge amount of money without much of a plan, isn't it?
Well, again, if you go back to the business-as-usual model, this is what they'd come to expect.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a different environment. They were sent packing, and, you know, it was a bipartisan farewell party.
Right.
You did not see the Democratic leadership providing much love there.
Mm-hmm.
And those hearings were brutal,
mm-hmm.
Again, from both sides of the aisle. And I appreciate that folks in the labor movement, particularly from the UAW, are very worried, and rightfully so, because their livelihoods are at stake, and the livelihoods of millions of Americans are at stake. But I think the message here is not no, but rather a different way.
Right.
And you've got to really kind of bore down here and come up with a business model that's viable moving forward.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's try and do this in about a minute. Jim from Salt Lake City, because we'll be out of time. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Kathleen. Really quick. I know your guest addressed if they mail their absentee ballots far enough in advance that they might get it back, notifying that there's an issue. What about the rest of the absentee ballots that are considered non-countable? Do they let the voters know that their vote wasn't registered?
Well, there was a ruling in Ramsey County earlier last week that said yes. But there was a dispute as to whether that was considered private information. But in Ramsey County and about half the counties, that information is now publicly available. And it appears that the campaigns are actually going to track some people down to let them know. But you can get that information through some of these counties. That information will be available if you Googled it.
Thank you so much. It's always a great pleasure to have you on the air, Professor Jacobs. Let us know when you have any more of those great conferences coming up, too.
Okay, great. We're actually going to have a big conference early in December with the top election officials in Minnesota and around the country.
Oh, great. All right. We're on it. We'll join you somehow. Thank you so much. Our guest this hour, Professor Lawrence Jacobs. He's director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs, also teaches political science at the University of Minnesota. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to Rhonda as well for on-air production. And we welcome to our little team here, Rob Schroeder, who just joined us today, who will be doing production work and all kinds of things. So welcome, Rob. News coming up. We'll return on the Ideas Network.